thank you, Sharon, for bringing spirit in and bringing day in and bringing in this mercy. Mercy me. We can use it as an exclamation point, but we can also use it to talk about what's at the heart of our hearts and what we're really capable of as a species, that we're capable of mercy. We're capable of compassion. We're capable of justice, including eco-justice. And that's why we gather on this wonderful, beautiful Earth Day weekend and Passover season. It's unusual for Passover to fall on Earth Day and Earth Day to fall on Passover, but I think it's a lesson going on here. What, after all, is this archetype of Passover, this story of Passover? Remember, it was the Jews were a oppressed group in Egypt, and the angel of death was unleashed. They were instructed that if they killed a sacrificed a lamb, poured the lamb's blood on their doors, the angel of death would pass by. Now, who wouldn't want to be at that kind of an occasion to ward off the angel of death? The angel of death today is called climate change. So this festival, this feast day, this archetype of letting the angel of death pass by, I think it applies to all of us today. We're all feeling it, this angel of death. The angel of death, of course, is also slavery. And the Jews felt that under the Egyptian pharaohs. And they had another breakthrough, the Exodus. And of course, the same breakthrough, the same liberation from slavery that Exodus names fed the vision and the courage and the passion of slaves in our country and of the whole civil rights movement, for sure. So this weekend is filled with possibilities. And of course, the angel of death is represented not only by climate change, but by all the history of slavery. And there are many dimensions to the history of slavery. Just to get concrete, this being a presidential election year, slavery influenced so much of our Constitution, including the decision to create the Electoral College instead of direct vote in a democratic way. These were all compromises to keep slaveholders content. And of course, addiction is another expression of slavery. Any kind of addiction, whether it be alcohol or drugs or work or sex or anything else that humans are good at, we can get too good at it. So there too, we are honoring, we're remembering the liberation that Passover is and that Exodus is. And of course, this time on our television internets daily, we of course are reliving war. That addiction, that temptation, that desire to kill one another, because we don't deal enough with the differences and the arguments. We want to turn them into this reptilian brain thing where I win and you lose, where there's only one winner in a reptilian brain consciousness. Think about it. Ever wrestled with a crocodile? Only one of you wins. Only one of you wins. That's the reptilian brain unleashed. And it's 420 million years old in every one of us. Think about that. Meditate on that. Your oldest brain, 420 million years old, that's old. And it thinks it can dominate. It has the last word. But the truth is, we have another brain too, don't we? The 210 million year old brain, half as old, that mammal brain. Mammal brain, capable of kinship, love, what families bring, whether they're families of whales or families of chimpanzees or families of humans and hominids. So all this comes up, it seems to me, when we have this unique conflagration of Passover and of Earth Day. And of course, this is why the Christians, who were, of course, originally Jews, leapt on the idea of the Passover. And Paul, the first writer in the Christian Bible, said, quote, "Christ is our Passover." So that's what you really call appropriation. That's taken over a whole tradition from Judaism. But it's so rich and it's so full, and we're saying the same things. That liberation matters. Another word for liberation is redemption. And above all, that liberation is possible. And so when Jesus said at his Last Supper, "Do this in memory of me," this carried forward for 2,000 years in the Christian tradition, that we are remembering the ancestors who were delivered from slavery in Egypt, right up through the civil rights movement and so many other movements. So can we apply to that angel of death, can we apply the same kind of hope and possibility as occurred among our ancestors? Now, Thomas Aquinas is one of my favorite mystics, and primarily because he worked so closely with scientists in his day. He overturned hundreds of years of theology in the West that was dualistic, that was patriarchal. I call him a proto-feminist because Rosemary Ruther, a great feminist of my generation, says the foundation of patriarchy is dualism. Dualism between matter and spirit, body and soul. And Aquinas spent his whole lifetime bringing Aristotle in to wash away the Neoplatonism and the dualism that had reigned in Christian theology for hundreds and hundreds of years. For example, St. Augustine, who was very steeped in Neoplatonism, said, and I quote, "Spirit is whatever is not matter," unquote. That's as dualistic as you can get. Aquinas said, in complete opposition, quote, "Spirit is the elan, the vitality in everything. A blade of grass out there has spirit. The fir trees out there have spirit. A horse has spirit. A tree has spirit. The galaxies have spirit. They're moving and moving us." That's a big job, folks. And they're pulling it off. And Aquinas also said, and I quote, "The first and primary meaning of salvation is this, to preserve things in the good," unquote. Goodness. Where's hell? Hell isn't in that definition of salvation. And escaping matter in the earth is not in that definition of salvation and redemption. What's wrong with this guy? Who does he think he is? Why haven't we heard from this guy? I can't imagine a better definition of salvation or redemption, moving out of slavery in a time of eco-crisis, than this one sentence from a pre-modern thinker. Ah, that's the key. Pre-modern. We remembered the indigenous people in this land. They're pre-modern. Indigenous people and pre-modern mystics like Aquinas do do not begin with the human. They begin with the whole. But the Lakota people say all our relations, aho mitakiasi, every time they pray, all our relations. But it begins with the cosmos. And that's where science begins, doesn't it? Descartes, modern thinker, I think, therefore I am. Are you kidding me? Does Descartes think he made himself? What about the 13.8 billion years that preceded him? Bully for you, Descartes, but get out of our way and stay out of our schools and our academic programs, because that's what's killing the earth. I think, therefore I am. No. It's we that brought us here. We. 13.8 billion years. And where is here? Here, we just learned a few summers ago, is 2 trillion galaxies. 2 trillion galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars. That's what here is. That's our home. Thomas Aquinas said, pre-modern thinker like he is, the greatest thing in the universe, the most excellent thing in the universe, is not the human. The most excellent thing in the universe is the universe itself. And all beings are here to serve the universe. That's where we get ecology, folks. Thomas Berry says ecology is functional cosmology. It's the hood of the cosmos, our Earth is. It's our hood. It's a little place, but a beautiful place. In a special place, in a sacred place. And we're not treating it that way. Let's show a couple of slides. This is a recent picture of the universe from Webb Telescope, which is doing so much to fill our hearts with beauty, with goodness, with the wonders of our existence. These are 2 galaxies dancing together, getting together out there in this vast and beautiful universe. And then this next picture, we've all seen it and called the blue dot, but it's that picture taken from Jupiter 1. When Jupiter 1, the first artifact the humans have produced that has left the solar system, looked back on its journey. And it looked back and took these pictures. And if you look very carefully, there are many, 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 many beings that it's traveled through in this journey. But the dot there that's showing, the blue dot, is our home and Jupiter's home, where humans with ingenuity and science and technology were created, able to create an instrument like that, as later we've now come up with the Webb Telescope. Very ingenious species we are. But I think it's so important that we balance or bring along with that icon that the astronauts took 50 years ago, that picture of the Earth as a single being. We've been living with that for 50 years. It's made a big difference. We have to add this icon to it too. Because this shows how singular, but also how fragile and how alone our planet can be. And yet on that planet, on that blue dot, is everything we know. All our ancestors, all our teachers, all our loved ones, the animals and the birds, and all the marvelous species that grace our planet. I think we have one more slide. And this is another picture from Webb Telescope. And it's interesting, your first response was ah and ah. It should be, damn it. This is what religion should be teaching. And this is what science should be teaching. It's not enough to get all the facts right. We got to bring it to the heart to the human heart. Aquinas says that the proper objects of the heart are truth and justice. But they're not in the head. They're in the heart. And that's what gets humans moving. In the heart is also sadness and fear. But there's also the wonder, and it begins with wonder. Awe is the beginning of wisdom, says Rabbi Heschel. And to hear the ahs is to hear the awe in the room. And that's so important, because that's where the energy lies, where the fire is. Get us moving. I read the other day a word that spoke to me. Someone said, we are living in bleak times. Bleak times. Well, we are. There's bad news all around us. And there's wars raging in Sudan, in Ukraine, and of course in Gaza. And how do you combat bleakness? What's the medicine for bleakness? Is it just to turn off the news because it's too disturbing? Or is it to go into denial and say, oh, this stuff isn't worth talking about? Including, of course, the fact that we're facing our own extinction as a species because of what's happening to the earth. And, of course, what's happening to the earth is mostly human-made. Well, Aquinas says zeal, and I think zeal is the opposite of bleakness. Zeal is energy. Zeal comes from a profound experience of the beauty of things and the goodness of things. For Aquinas, beauty and goodness are the same thing, except that beauty adds is a little more intellectual, he says. There's an intellectual sense of harmony to beauty that goodness, just raw goodness, is not engaged in so much. But they're really the same word, he says. He says, God is sheer goodness, and all things are good. All things are good. That's what I mean by original blessing. Blessing is a theological word for goodness. Aquinas talks about original goodness. I got condemned by two popes over 34 years for talking about original blessing. The roof of the Vatican came off. It blew the roof of the Vatican off. They called my work, quote, dangerous and deviant, unquote. Two popes, but not the present pope. So I live long enough to hear two popes call my work dangerous and deviant, and one to plagiarize my work. Insofar as his encyclical on the environment, Laudate Si, Pope Francis' encyclical, which Brian Swim, a cosmologist, has called the best scientific work ever produced by Rome, ever to come out of Rome. That encyclical was written by one of my students from Holy Names College, Catholic priest from Ireland who was a missionary in the Philippines. And after graduating with a master's degree from our program, he went back to the Philippines and wrote a series of small books on spirituality and ecology. And obviously Pope Francis read them, or one of them, plucked him up from the Philippines and brought him to Rome. So he wrote 80% of that encyclical. And Leonardo Boff, another friend of mine, liberation theologian from Brazil, wrote 15% of it. And so I'm kind of proud of that. I'm glad for your cheers, too, about popes who don't know that they don't know everything. So goodness and beauty are at the heart of firing us up, doing something. But something that doesn't come just from fear or from action and reaction, but comes from the heart, comes from a deep place, the place where we cherish the good. For example, Meister Eckhart says, who is a good person? A good person praises good people. I just love that. It's very practical. Check it out. Bad people do not praise good people. Aquinas says a tyrant is more afraid of good people than of bad people. Check that out. In contemporary history, you can check that out. I won't name any names. A good person, therefore, is a hunter-gatherer after goodness. And we find it in nature. Of course, there's also strife, and there's winners and losers in nature, yeah. But the first point is that nature is good, the whole universe, and that's what the Bible says on page one, which is a cosmology. Not only is every being that's mentioned called good, but when it's all together at the end and humans are aboard, yeah, even when we come on board, it's called very good. That's a surprise. There's an answer to bleakness. One of the commandments, the first commandment in creation spirituality is this: fall in love at least three times a day. Fall in love at least three times a day. And this is not meant to endanger your marriage or any other relationship you're in. I'm not trying to say that, but I am trying to say this in capital letters. We have to de-anthropocentrize falling in love. You can fall in love with wildflowers. You can fall in love with your dog, your cat, your horse, with music, with poetry, with a galaxy every day, with a planet every day. That's what we're all about, folks. Falling in love is not just about falling in love with one two-legged one and saying, till death do us part. That's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful vow, and I wish you luck. But it's not the sole experience of falling in love. And to be alive and to be in love is to be ready and eager and hungry to fall in love on a regular basis. And when that happens, we do not fall into denial. We do not fall into despair. And there is a lot of despair floating around these days, folks. I'll never forget, a few years ago, just before COVID, I was doing a retreat at Rowe Center, UU Center, Retreat Center in Massachusetts. And there was a fellow there, you know, leading another retreat, and he had like 35 followers or what have you. And I'd never heard of him, blah, blah, blah. When I was being driven to the airport after the three-day thing, I asked the driver, who was that other fellow who was leading the retreat? He said, that guy's publishing books on how humanity is finished. Yeah, we're finished, so just eat, drink, and be merry. There's nothing we can do about all the damage we've done. And it really dawned on me, you know, people are making money on despair. Thomas Aquinas says, the worst thing a human being can do is to teach despair. Because despair, he says, is not the worst of sins, injustice is. But when we fall into despair, we don't care about ourselves, so we sure as hell don't care about anyone else. It is a killing of compassion, therefore. It is the most dangerous. And it's everywhere today. And I think even in politics around the world, this yearning for a strong man to save us, that's really coming out of a sense of despair. And it's abandoning our own responsibility and our own possibilities. So I'm going to talk about this more when in our workshop this afternoon. You know, what can we do? But really what I'm doing here in our worship service and what Sharon has done, you see, is to bring in this energy, this fire that we call love or compassion. You know, Teilhard de Chardin, the great scientist and mystic and poet, he said that we shouldn't just say God is love, we should say the world is love. And that's after he studied profoundly the history of evolution. He was trying to redo Christianity, that evolution is not a problem, it's an affirmation that 13.8 billion years have produced consciousness, have produced a capacity for love. And this is what this crisis is all about, I think, as we face our extinction today, that it is rattling our cages. And by cages, I mean education and law and politics and religion, all of it rattling our cages because it's failing us. It's not worthy of us. It was all designed for the modern era, and we're not in a modern era. We no longer believe that I think, therefore I am. What nonsense. What we believe is this 13.8 billion years have brought us here, and there's a purpose for our being here. It is not to kill the planet. It's to grow, to continue the growth. And that's what all the great spiritual avatars of the world have been telling us, that we're here for compassion. We're capable of it. And compassion is a divine attribute. That's the Jewish tradition. In the Jewish tradition, compassion is the secret name for God. And Jesus, Jew that he was, let the secret out of the bag in the Sermon on the Mount in Luke 6, be you compassionate as your Creator in heaven is compassionate. That's our divinity. He's naming our divinity. But he's not alone. The Dalai Lama said a few years ago, we can do away with all religion. By the way, we're getting pretty good at that. But we can't do away with compassion. He said, compassion is my religion. Well, to me, that's a paraphrase of what Jesus said in Luke 6. And this is what's happening today. We have to simplify, get down to the bare bones and the essence of what our great teachers taught us. And not just the Buddha and Dalai Lama, but in the Jewish tradition, but in the Quran, by far. The most common adjective applied to Allah is Allah, the compassionate one. So check it out, folks. These are the great mystics among our ancestors. And some of them, not all, got their stuff written down. And then we go to war over what it means, of course, which I think kind of misses the point. So, one other thing that happened this week that I think is very interesting and promising, actually. Scientists created this one study about the economic implications of climate change. Just about that, nothing else. And this is what they found, that by the year 2050, at the rate we're going now, we will be losing, by we, I mean the entire global economy, $38 trillion a year just because of the heat. Now, how much is $38 trillion a year? The current global economy is $100 trillion a year. So it's more than a third of present-day economy. American economy is $6 trillion a year. And we're going to be losing 38 in 25 years? Are you kidding me? And it points out that Germany and America and a lot of Europe, their economy will drop by $20 trillion or 20%. And then if we don't do stuff before then, it'll go to 60% by the end of the century. So what I find promising about this, you might think I'm a little weird, but you know, most people get out of the couches when they have to, you know, that humans respond to necessity. And when you're talking money, that's when even corporations might pay attention. And that's the point that they said, that it's going to be much cheaper to start acting deeply now than to wait till then, right? Let's not lose $39 trillion when we don't have to as a species. So I'll develop this more in the project in the afternoon workshop. But I think, in an odd way, it's good news to get this down there, because a lot of people don't respond, a lot of corporations don't respond, except to that, quote, bottom line. And most of us have not been talking about that kind of thing as you've been urging more attention to the suffering of Mother Earth. And finally, let me just point out this story, that I find myself meditating a lot these days on all these new species, new hominids that science is uncovering in our lifetime. You know, we knew about Neanderthal, and now we know that many of us have some DNA in our blood, which proves that we were not just making war with the Neanderthals over the centuries. And we knew about the Denisons, who, especially people, Philippines. The Philippine people have a lot of DNA from that hominid species. But now they've uncovered another 14 or 15 hominid species, and we're finding new ones all the time, many of them in Southeast Asia. And we're giving them names and finding out things about them. These are all our cousins. But hey, folks, this is the bottom line. Every one of them is extinct. We can be too. We can be too. So that's where the whole question goes back to goodness and beauty and love and gratitude. If we can stir up the thankfulness for our being brought into this 13.8 billion year history, that will be the fire that gets climate change to move beyond. Aquinas said, compassion is the fire that Jesus came to set on the earth. Compassion is the fire. So I think these considerations are worthy considering on Earth Day. And I want to commend the church here for your wonderful new labyrinth. I've been here just several times in the past, but it's the first time I've been here to see your labyrinth and the restored labyrinth. I love how the dirt is honored there. It's not all stone and rock like at the cathedral at Grace. You've honored earth to participate. You can walk on the earth while you're doing your labyrinth. But it's a good sign that human ingenuity has so many options at this time. But despair and bleakness and self-pity and giving up is not one of them. It's not worthy of us as a species. Thank you.